just with a small, precise saw. It's a sound she is glad she won't be awake to hear. The veins, they are managed with the most delicate pair of scissors, though, of course, they are actually stainless steel, medical. Summer imagines her mother's sewing scissors, shaped like a crane with a beak that opens and closes, wings that separate and fold together. Mother of pearl inlay and one bright blue eye. Probably, Summer explains, there will need to be two surgeons working in tandem. Hands off, hands on. They'll begin early in the morning and finish well after dark. 1,000 tiny cuts, 1,000 tiny repairs. Kit has to act surprised. He says,
I'm not going to forget about you. We don't have to do this.
Kit knows that he has this one chance to say no. If he doesn't, he will be doubly complicit, both amputee and surgeon. We don't have to do anything. This one I'm asking for. I'm thinking January. He looks at her. It's a story, and he does not refuse. Kit chooses the island for its remoteness, its fringy palms, the color of the sea. He looks at pictures on the internet from other people's vacations. They are tan, and their towels are covered in sand, and they have coconuts with straws. It looks like a good place to be disappointed. Kit knows that land is actual, crossable, and that in a certain number of travel hours, they will arrive on the other side of the Pacific Ocean and no willing hand surgeon will be there to meet them. He knows that the story will end differently than promised, but he does not know what to do other than keep moving forward. Kit has run through a series of possibilities. Find a real doctor to do a real surgery, find a fake doctor to do a fake surgery, or the fantasy that feels most possible, go somewhere far away where Kit's invented doctor supposedly works, but when they get there, it's just a local clinic where no one speaks English, certainly nowhere for a complicated procedure, and the doctor suddenly stops writing back to Summer, but the island is so beautiful, so warm, and the water is thick with brightly colored fish, and the beach is long and moon-shaped. And Kit and Summer sleep in the jungle and they eat strange fruits, and Summer finds that she is satisfied, better. That death recedes into the far future, and their love is bigger than ever before, and they don't go home for months because Kit is rich, because his parents were rich, and this is an inexpensive country and they can live on the water's edge while the entire winter passes at home. All the storms, all the months of slushy sea, until it thaws there, and Kit and Summer return with darkened skin and longer hair, and they can open every single window in the house and drag their sarongs out onto the lawn and pretend it's Asia. Somewhere in there, Summer's idea, her need, will drift upward and look small, disappear from sight. In the airport, Kit and Summer sit near a window holding hands and looking out at the geography of grays before them, tarmac, airplane, sky. The orange-vested flight control man is the single bright spot. Summer is not sure Kit believes her plan yet. She suspects that he thinks it is a fantasy. She suspects that his excitement is for a vacation in a nation with spicy foods and good beaches, tremendous golden Buddhas and places where orphaned elephants paint with their trunks. That's fair. His love is dying any day. Certainly a vacation is deserved. Kit is inside of the lie now and can't see out. The invention has its own heartbeat, and it has carried them from their small house on their small island across to the mainland, to the airport. The actual airport where an actual plane is being loaded with dinner, breakfast, snack, and a stewardess in high heels is arranging tiny Zinfandel bottles in her cart and checking to be sure that there is a safety information card in each seat back pocket. Kit knows he should have admitted to being part of the world that is not sure what to do with her. But here is the invention carrying them along. Here is the gate attendant announcing the first boarding group. Here is the body, and here are the wings. He notices that Summer is breathing sharply, and she can't keep her hands still. Of course, he realizes, inside her, the wreck of her parents' plane is a hot cinder. Kit says to her, "This is a big plane. Big planes don't crash. If we go down, you have to promise that we'll both die. I can't be the only survivor again," she says. He gives her his pinky to swear by. There are wind-blown white curtains in their hut, and a squat toilet, and the sand is bright gold outside, and the sea is an almost unimaginable shade. It makes Summer's stomach hurt to look at a blue that blue. Summer and Kit fall into that water, and it catches them, warm. A large gold dog paddles out to them like they need saving, and Summer puts her arms out and lets the dog hug her, scratching, trying to keep everyone afloat.
"Sweetheart," Kit says, "do we need to worry about rabies?"
Summer, already dying, is free from worry now, she says. The stray dog licks her face and looks proud even though Summer is doing all the swimming. When she comes out, her white legs are striped with scratches. There is no white shine to the clinic floor, no humming lights, no gurneys or nurses in comfort clogs. There is no waiting room with magazines and fake plants or real ones. There is not even a door. Kit and Summer walk out of the jungle and up three concrete stairs into a tiled room. A fan stirs the air, and a young girl sits at a wooden desk with a stack of paper and pens. She smiles at them and says, "Please, your shoes." At the doorway, Summer notices a line of sandals.
"Shoes off?" Kit asks.
She nods. Barefootedness felt good on the beach, exotic in the restaurant, upsetting in a hospital.
"Is this the right place?"
Kit whispers, acting. Summer looks around and cannot tell. She takes his hand. They watch a door open and a mother walks out holding a baby. The mother wears a t-shirt that reads, "Beautiful today." It has a cartoon of a cat with a mouse in its jaw. The baby stretches one tiny arm out and opens her hand like something good is going to fall into it. A small man walks out after them and comes to stand before Kit and Summer. He, too, is shoeless. They cannot tell how old he is, a trick of this continent. Skin here does not record time's passage in the same way. Sun and wind and years slip right over. "Hello," he says, putting his hands together and bowing slightly. In the emails, Summer had noted an education, certainly Western, good grammar. This doctor is foreign. "We're here for the hand transplant," Summer says. She draws a line on her left wrist. "It's so that I can go everywhere with him, which sounds crazy when you say it, but not crazy when you think it." Her face is hot and blooded.
"Yes, yes,"
the doctor says.
"Yes?"
Kit asks. The doctor takes Summer's hands and holds them in his own, which are unbearably soft. An American man would be shy to touch anyone with hands that soft. He studies her pinky, feeling each bone, pressing her nail and watching it widen.
"Very good," he says.
Next, he takes Kit's hand, rolls the fingers back and forth, bends the knuckles and straightens them. Kit, too, notes the softness of the man's skin. He notices a ring on his finger. A woman loves this man, lives in a house with him, trusts her children to him, spends long, dark hours with him beside her.
Bones, a challenge.
Oh, says Summer.
Oh?
Kit looks at the man and tries to ask him with his eyes what he means. A crossing of wires, he tells himself. No one understands what anyone else is saying. Summer notices that all the light is natural, tinted green by the jungle outside. There is not a bulb in the place. Summer worries then about power, about the necessary machinery for keeping a body alive under surgical stress. Do you have machines? Summer asks. The doctor taps his skull and smiles. She says, no, something to make definite of breathing. Why, she wonders, does she have the instinct to speak bad English in hopes of being understood? The doctor comes close to Summer and cups his ear around her mouth.
Breathing, he says. Same? Same.
The doctor provides the couple with a series of pills. Kit tries to understand if these are herbs or vitamins or drugs, but the answer to every question is a welcoming smile.
You feel better. Thank you, the doctor says. Come back Monday.
Why the other white people are here? To put on scuba gear and watch brightly colored fish deep below the surface of the clear, clear sea is the first reason. The second is to celebrate the moon. Probably the moon is an excuse to wear less clothing than is usually considered reasonable, and to dance as a pack or a tribe or a flock and spin fireballs above their heads so fast that they draw lines of orange in the darkness. And also the point is to swallow pills and smoke whatever comes around and, if they last long enough, to become even nakeder and pair up, get some of that soft sand in awkward places. Toward the end, when the sun has started to rise again, that's when the people on the beach most appreciate the moon. Enough light to see by, enough dark to hide. Kit and Summer do not want to dance all night with other people their age who have traveled far to make bad decisions while barefoot. They do, however, want to watch from a distance, at least for a while. The restaurant at the resort at the top of the hill has a good view of the beach, is open late, and is supposed to have good fish. You choose your dinner alive, and they smash the skull for you on the spot. The woman at their guest house says she'll call them a taxi, but Kit looks up and he sees the resort right there above them.
We'll walk, Kit says.
Bat wings sound different than bird wings. The leather of them slaps at the air. The jungle is thick and ragged with life. It feels like the trees are growing right this minute, adding new inches as Kit and Summer try to keep a path beneath. Rocks and bats and trees, and the small pocket flashlight is not enough to see by. Summer slips down a hill and her skirt comes up to allow a big bruise on her thigh. They arrive at a cliff, not a resort. Below them is the sea, not blue. At this hour, the sea is white. They stay on the cliff's edge, recovering from the hike. The sea makes a good song to rest to. The bass from the full moon party reaches them faintly, and they think of all those bodies moving together in the white light. Kit makes up a song and takes out some tamarind candies, which they share. They are hungry, but they do not want to risk the walk back until daylight. They'll stay the night. At least here they can see where they are. At least here they know where the edge is.
We should put something on your bruise, Kit says. Having no salve, he spits in his hand.
This will help,
he says, sweeping it across her leg.
This will heal.
For Summer, it becomes obvious she and her sweetheart are not great at organizing hand transplants. They are good at swimming and eating fish lunches, and they found their way out of the jungle eventually, bravely. Her boy is so kind and helps teenagers get better at writing, and he reads in the morning and he has a predictable breakfast order and no parents either. He's perfect. But he's not the man for this job, just as she is not the woman for it. Maybe they got the address wrong. She has written to the surgeon every day, but he has stopped responding. She worries about him because he is so reliable and, therefore, must be injured. Maybe the very fancy hospital was in Bangkok, where all the foreign ladies go to get plastic surgery cheaper and with discretion. The doctors there have all gone to Stanford and Harvard. That's where the famous hand guy is. She imagines that he has a collection of little moon bones on his windowsill, and a Thai wife whose strange culture and luscious hair do not distract him from taking care of her like a full and complete woman, an equal. And they have three little mixed babies and another on the way, and he's working on a book about hands, which is really a love letter to what he thinks is the most magnificent invention the body has ever invented. Not to mention the fact that the hands are indispensable for all other human inventions. Within this book, there is a chapter, still just notes, about Summer and Kit and the beautiful story still to unfold of their joined bodies, of the ways they will hold each other and care for each other with hands that are not their own. Summer worries about the doctor and his unwritten book, the chapter he won't be able to complete without her. She thinks of him, cutting and repairing bones and veins and muscles. She thinks of him enabling so much work for the bearers of these hands, hammering, hugging, winding the watch, flipping the egg, dialing up the parents, turning the key to drive home, washing the child's hair, unbuttoning the wife's blouse, twitching in sleep, writing the letter to say goodbye. This island is no place for major surgery. Summer writes a note about needing a walk, leaves her napping darling on the bed. It's the first time she's been alone in this foreign nation, and it surprises her how different it is. She feels skinned, permeable, a magnet for disease and danger. One of those full moon dancers could be asleep in the bushes, still drugged and rabid and terrible and hungry for just the kind of ankles the girl possesses. Plus, wet and warm places are snake hangouts, and who knows how to tell the venomous ones from the non. She hears various rustles and moves to the center of the road where the soft red dirt has gathered in a ridge between tire tracks. Her feet turn color, and so do her sandals. If only the birds would quit alighting on branches and looking at her like they are ready to pick her clean. Summer takes her shoes off and waits for the doctor, whose low voice she hears in one of the rooms. A little boy comes out with a fresh bandage on his foot. His mother has an envelope Summer knows contains medicine. Everyone here has been taken care of. Whatever the wound was is clean now. Ointmented, covered. The woman and her child will go home and report the accident and the happy ending to the boy's father.
Shark bite, the doctor says to Summer.
She thinks of all the swimming they've been doing. She thinks of the morsel of a leg. She thinks of the beach full of orphan dogs in the shallows.
Kidding. Jokes, the doctor says. No sharks here. Your country is sharks. He step on nail.
Don't cut our hands off, Summer says. Make up an excuse. Let my boyfriend down easy.
Feel better?
Do you understand?
The doctor is already walking away. Watch out for shark! He laughs. See you Monday.
The plan was dumb. Kit knows that now. All this distance, but you drag your same old bones, your same old brain with you. Summer has not forgotten why they came here. So he goes to the doctor for a talk. The road is dusty and he admires the birds along his path. It smells like tea here and he could eat the good fruits for the rest of his life and hardly anything else would be needed.
Look, he says when he gets there, I don't know what's going on here.
Kit and the doctor are standing in the hallway, which is dark, and there is a rusted scale and a bag of laundry hanging on a hook.
Thailand is holiday. You should not spend all of time at my office.
I lied to my girlfriend, but I did it to be nice. We don't want hand surgery. Please do not give us hand surgery, is what I'm saying.
You are not married?
No.
Why wait? It's better.
She might be dying. She doesn't want to weigh my life down. What will you say about the surgery? That there were technical problems?
Try foot massage on beach. Try fresh coconut. Elephants for bathing are here. Eat first thing. Some people prefer suntan and dance music. Quiet? Okay too. See you Monday. I'll take good care.
The doctor closes himself into a room. Kit puts his shoes on. He hadn't missed them. The hotel has a brochure for deep-sea diving that advertises an available friendly of small fishes. It's irresistible, Summer says, meaning we can't resist it. They have to go underwater with someone since they don't know how. First, some information and a quiz and a medical questionnaire. Summer sees this and gets nervous, already trying to decide if she will lie or not. She wants the available friendly, needs it even. She scans. Pregnancy, head cold, history of heart attack, lung disease, epilepsy, head injury, blackouts. But nothing about general predisposition for death. Summer is relieved. She checks all the no boxes and goes to the mask area to try on masks. Their instructor is a blonde from Australia with a high voice from all the oxygen tank breathing and a neck tattoo of a mermaid twisted up with a serpent. He is responsible for their lives. He says,
"Press to your face and then suck in."
There was a trial swim in shallow water where they learn how to breathe again. It's weird not to know. To have to pull hard to get that bottled air in, and then to blow it out and see the bubbles. They have to learn to clear water from their masks, and they have to learn to give each other air in case one of them should run out when they are deep down. Summer takes a deep breath and then passes her sucker over to her beloved and watches his chest inflate. She's anxious to get her breather back, even though she has always been able to hold her breath a long time. This is one of the things about herself that she knows and is proud of. Many vacations she spent in the pool, daring boys to outdive her. She'd streak across the pool, letting the burn her lungs, and when she came up, finally, the boys would be panting, holding the edge, questioning her humanness. They said, "Are you a fish?" But she remembers them calling her a sorcerer mermaid instead. Kit hands Summer his breather, and she sees him there in the water with her, his eyes magnified in the mask, tiny bubbles escaping his pursed lips. It's terrible not to be able to kiss him then. Summer borrows a breath from her love. Descending along the rock wall, they look down and see progressively bigger fish below them. The water gets colder. Kit takes Summer's hand for a minute before they let go to swim better. Coral is fingery, and the little fish thread through. They see a turtle and an eel and a giant clam with luminous purple flesh. Kit admires the way a sandy spot looks in the blue cast of the waterlight. Some fish nip at the rocks and coral. Some fish eat algae off other fish. There is so much alive here that it seems staged. Summer swims at a big school of tiny silvers, and they break for her, rejoin after a distance. The ancestors made a mistake, crawling out onto land, Kit thinks. Something glides past. The instructor makes butterfly wings with his hands to explain, but Kit and Summer are not watching him and would not understand his hand language anyway. They know it's a ray. All these creatures are familiar from public access television. But the ray flies, and Kit and Summer could not have predicted how that would stir them. Water is so much more generous than air. The ray hardly flaps its wings to soar. The morning arrives. Monday. It came after Sunday and before the Tuesday, and that should not have been a surprise. It had seemed so far away, and the impossibility of that notation. The fact that hand replacement surgery was written on the particular square of the calendar made the day itself seem unlikely. But here it is, sunny and tired. Summer is up, spearing a slice of banana. She is wearing a white sundress. Kit takes his body through motion after motion. He brushes and washes and combs and dresses. He eats and drinks. See that? Just a day. The ocean is always and already churning. Kit imagines what's underneath. Everything is eating. Everything is searching. They hold hands on the walk. Summer tells him that she is grateful for his help, for making this journey. Both of them think of home, but neither says the word. No animals cross their path, no snakes. The birds in the trees that morning are ordinary and brown. Neither Kit nor Summer remembers their dreams, and both wish they had. Wish for a symbol tossed up from the unconscious. At the steps of the clinic, Kit and Summer kick off their shoes like they're coming home, as if comfort is imminent. They are led by a woman into a darkened room with a cushioned floor. She gives them each a pair of loose pants and leaves the room. Kit and Summer put on the pants and sit down on the floor. They do not know what is happening to them. Each has asked for a reprieve, is here in hopes that the doctor will relieve them of their own story. Two women enter and kneel beside Kit and Summer, who lie down on their backs. The women climb on top, bend a leg around their own small breathing torsos. The bodies are tangled and bent. The women kneel on thighs, pull limbs up and back. It hurts, for Kit especially. How could someone so small be this crushing? Something strong and herbal is brewing in the room. This is an entirely new smell. His girl has her eyes closed, and her body is making shapes Kit hasn't seen it make before. He has a hard time catching his breath, and in this state he realizes it's a massage. We're getting a massage. He has a small woman on his chest, which keeps him from laughing like he wants to. He feels his blood moving through his legs when they are finally released back to the floor. His body, his head feel hot and good. Kit risks a joke.
This surgery is nice.
Next time, let's switch legs. Summer hears her beloved laugh. She wants to thank the doctor for this day, for these women who are crawling over the two of them and pressing joint to joint. The hotel has been recommending a massage every day.
No pain, no gain,
the waiter told them, pleased to know this Americanism.
Massage, fix every problem.
Kit says, let's get married. That's what other people our age do when they feel this way.
The women place little warm steamed bundles of herbs along Kit's and Summer's bodies. The smell is delicious and nauseating at the same time. The women stretch Kit and Summer back into their normal shapes and then leave. The room is steamy and dark, and this is what relief feels like. Kit reaches over and holds on to Summer's thumb. It is not long before Kit and Summer fall asleep. Summer wakes up first. She can't find her balance in the room. She can see her love asleep next to her, his face this far away from where she's used to seeing it. He's beautiful. She should tell him this more. A memory floats in. She is a kid and she still has parents. They're out for ice cream and Summer is sucking the gum squares out of her cone and spitting them onto a napkin. She always got bubblegum ice cream, even though it was not the best flavor, because you got two desserts in one. The bargainer in her had to make this choice. Her tongue was blue, she knew, because she stuck it out and cross-eyed to see it. Her mother was saying something about a dog, and her father was saying something about a roofer. A group of crazy people came in, each with his or her own strangeness. One was stooped and was hook-armed with a very short woman who limped. One was wearing too many shades of purple. One had the eyes that made it clear what her disorder was, and she carried a bright pink purse. Summer looked for the uncrazy person in the group, the one who was tending, leading, hurting, but she couldn't figure out who it was. Someone needed to be normal and adult, but no one looked it. Summer was worried for the crazies. She told her parents her concern, and they both laughed at her. She's so conscientious, her mother said, like this was an adorable but silly characteristic they hoped their daughter would grow out of. Like wanting to dance ballet, ride a painted pony, wear wide-hooped dresses. It was impractical to be the person she was. Better to grow a shell, to stop seeing so much. Summer ate her gums, one by one, all their color sucked off already, her mouth too full. So much spit. She had to concentrate to keep from gagging. Summer picks up her hand to scratch her nose, but she gets a big white bundle instead. Her hand is fatly gauzed, like it's been through something, like an accident. Summer looks to her love, and he also has a wrapped hand. She shakes her head around to wake it up. She almost shakes him, almost reaches out with her white mitt. But he's too lovely, too asleep. Summer digs the end out of the gauze and begins to unwrap. There are many turns, and she feels the pressure release as she goes. She is impatient at the same time that she does not want to see what is inside. She imagines unwrapping her darling's hand. She imagines blood. She imagines meat. Round and round, and finally she sees skin. She can't tell if it's her own because it is so swollen, waterlogged. This hand looks twice the size of the one she used to carry around on the end of her arm, and at the wrist, a bracelet of stitches. X, 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 X. It is the way she would have sewn something, not knowing how to sew. Beneath, there is a clean cut. It is beautiful, the cut. The cut is absolutely perfect.
The Lonesome Flats. Club Zeus. When Zeus knocked up Leto and Hera found out about it, she forbade the slutty girlfriend from birthing her twin babies on land. Leto rode the seas until she finally settled on a floating island, which the resort where I'm working claims is our own spit of land, and where I am 6 weeks into an 8-week summer job before I return to the United States for my last year of high school. There are ruins in the cliffs above the resort, grand columned things in honor of Leto, goddess of motherhood. But here at Club Zeus, we choose to commemorate all those gods and goddesses differently. Not that we don't have columns. We have plenty. We commemorate instead with the statue of a big-titted woman in the middle of the huge pool. We commemorate with a makeout pad full of pillows floating in the bay and held up by concrete swans called Delos after the island where Leto gave birth to Apollo and Artemis. Mostly we commemorate with as many beverages as you can suck back. Our guests are Russians and Brits who are fat and white when they arrive and fatter and red when they leave 6 nights, 7 days later. Most of the staff is Ukrainian, but I'm from California. My job is to be the wizened storyteller. I wear a distressed robe, rope sandals, and a fake beard. I sit in a hut all day and tell Greek myths to whoever comes in. It's kids in the morning, almost exclusively. The afternoon hour is a mixed bag of people who have been in the sun too long, people who have been at Club Zeus too long in general, and have exhausted all the other activities, and more kids. Some people just nap. At night, I get drunks. I can tell whatever story I want, so I tailor it to my audience. The drunks get the sexier stories and violence. Odysseus trapped on Calypso's island. Odysseus stabbing the giant dumb Cyclops in his big eye. The sirens. They tip very well if things get hot or bloody. At the end of the hour, I pass around a burlap satchel, hoping that guests will drop in some of their Leto liras, which they can use for any of the extra cost items like fake tattoos or sunscreen rubdowns by the roving belly dancers, and which I will trade in for postage stamps, gum, and phone cards. I came here to escape, but so far the pleasure has eluded me. My route to Club Zeus began with my mother's recent midlife swan dive into the pool of faith. When she discovered spirituality, her whole person sprouted as if there had been nothing there before, as if she had been an empty suitcase waiting to be packed. I was 15. I had never noticed anything about our home's furnishings until they were replaced. A flowered sofa was traded for a low Indonesian bench with throw pillows. White curtains were given away for brightly colored ones. The kitchen counter became populated with an army of spice jars, star anise, cumin, coriander, fenugreek, sumac, saffron. Mom purchased a meditation cushion and various beads to slip mindfully through her fingers. She wanted her awakening to be inclusive, all-encompassing, so there were rosary beads as well as Hindu prayer beads. She had a book of Sufi stories on top of a book of Zen koans. St. Francis, his arms beleaguered with birds, looked down upon a singing crystal bowl meant to cleanse the soul. My mother was happy. This cocktail of religions calmed her loneliness as if by prescription. Before this, Mom had been normal. The same hair and makeup as all the other moms, the same clothes, the mid-40s divorce, stucco fake fancy house, ambient depression. She had the same 3 to 5 glasses of white wine at dinner, the stream of dates with tanned faces and yachts and shitty work hours and insufficient capacities for commitment. This is what it is to grow up in white Orange County. Variation is a non-existent principle. I did the taking care of in our house. I was the one to scramble the eggs and clean the hair out of the drain, and Mom was grateful, always grateful. She told me every day that I would grow up to be the kind of man who knew how to treat a woman, that I would be the one good specimen in a state full of assholes. I was happy because I was needed. Then, an unreasonably good-looking blonde guy with orange robes and a necklace of marigolds rented what used to be an ice cream shop and hung fabric on the walls and an open sign on the door, and pretty soon, Mom started going for morning meditation and then afternoon meditation and then evening meditation, and then she went to church, too, and we lit candles on Friday nights and ate challah, and she did sage purification ceremonies and got a guy who said he was Cherokee to put a sweat lodge in our backyard. and Mom was suddenly able to take care of herself. She did the dishes, she cooked, she swept the floors. She had been saved, and I had been made obsolete. The deeper Mom went into her spiritual seas, the lonelier I got. One day in November of my junior year, in my fifth semester of the washboard scrape of high school, the geography teacher told us that high school is the stepping stone to college, and college is the stepping stone to a good job, and a good job is the stepping stone to wealth. And isn't that the point of life? Isn't that the great dream? It was clear to me that what high school really is a holding pen. We were too young to be trusted and too old to be cute. The teacher unfurled a map of the United States and opened a box of red-headed pins, which he would press to our dreamed-of college towns. University of Kansas, said Ethan Peters, and the teacher pinned and said, Lawrence, lovely town. Harvard, said Jessica Stride, who was pretty enough to risk being smart, and the teacher stabbed Cambridge. Everyone spouted their list of reach schools and safety schools. They were believers. They were on the path. The teacher came to me, and I stared at that map, and all I could see was the Pacific. All I could see was the edge, a place to leap off and escape. And it struck me, brick-like. All that ocean, all that land, the entire rolling globe, and I just beat a path from my unremarkable front door to this yellow-walled school, gum stuck under every desk, so that I can go somewhere in state, so that I can get a job, so that I can raise my kids to do the same? The best we can hope for, the very utmost dream, is to be naked with someone our own age or a little older and muck around with them in the dark? And I thought, the ocean. The whole entire ocean is right there, walking distance from where I sit. That day was the day of open eyes, of open roads, and my map included everywhere, just everywhere. I have to go to the bathroom, I said. From point A, which was room 203 of Newport High School, there was a very obvious path. Coast Highway, Bay Shore, stop for a few sandwiches to hold me for a day or two, and as much cash as I could withdraw, across the bridge to the little cottage-riddled island, wade into the bay to the most seaworthy-looking dinghy I could find, oars and oarlocks, and out. The destination hardly mattered. There were other cities, other towns, islands a few miles offshore, another country not far south. What mattered was the departure. I rode past the gigantic houses with their columns and statues, the big as-if of them. I rode past sea lions fatted out on the decks of yachts despite the netting the owners had installed. The yachts bowed waterward under all that amphibious weight. I glanced over my shoulder to keep a straight path, then turned and rode hard. Within 15 minutes, a police boat zipped in, flipped its lights on. I looked at my sandwiches in the hull, mayonnaise yellowing against the plastic, and I stopped dipping the oars. My big world shrank back down to the size of a postcard. The arrest was a surprise. I had never done anything bad or wrong, had always associated police uniforms with the 4th of July parade. They were nice to me, sort of. Not mean, anyway. No handcuffs, but they put me in the back of their car and read me my rights, and the jail cell smelled like microwave popcorn and wet concrete. I thought, shit. Oh, well. But still, shit. My hope turned pocket-sized, and then I couldn't even find it anymore. The warm feeling that had filled my chest, the feeling that maybe I would live a whole life after all, had cooled to ash. My mother brought me a Zuni fetish when she bailed me out. It was a little beaver the size of a fingernail, carved out of jasper. It had a tiny real stick in its mouth. Because you are so industrious, she said. Don't stop being that way. She never asked me why I stole the boat or where I thought I was going. It was as if she already knew, had waited for this day to come, as if she had done it once too. At home, she made me a sandwich since mine had all been confiscated. It was dark by then, and we sat at the table together. She drowned and saved her tea bag over and over. "You want to go somewhere?" she asked. "God, yes." "Okay." So as a gift for the first time I had ever gotten in trouble, and that's just how my mother put it, she would send me to Turkey for the summer. She had a friend who had an aunt who had a room to rent, and they were sure they could find me a summer job. I promised to finish the school year, not to try to run away, not to steal anything. She promised to find me the keys out of Orange County. Flying into the quaint coastal town made me sick in two ways. The choppy air rolled the plane back and forth, and the color of the sea was so rich it almost ached. The land was pine scrubby and dry, and I could make out wooden ships floating on the water. My mother's friend's old auntie lived in a little wooden house at the edge of town, which I walked to wearing my backpack, following a hand-drawn map. Jet lag felt like a wool coat I couldn't take off. I was sweating and hungry and overjoyed. The old woman met me at her iron gate, which had been devoured by bougainvillea. She showed me my room, a single bed, a dresser, and then sat me down in the kitchen and poured me a cup of deep red-brown tea in a delicate tulip-shaped glass. She put out a plate of sliced tomatoes, cucumbers, apricots, and a piece of crumbly white cheese along with a basket of baguette slices and a jar of sour cherry jam. It was the best meal I had eaten in my life. I looked up at her, and she looked fuzzy, almost not real, like a half-ghost. "What time is it?" I asked, suddenly aware that I had no idea when I was. I was woken a few hours later by an announcement over loudspeakers saying what I did not know. I joined the old woman on her small porch, and she made me another cup of tea, the second of 10,000 I would drink in the coming weeks. The tiny deck looked out over first the cemetery, then the roof of the corner store, then the road, then the harbor. Most people would try to ignore the foreground filled with human remains and enjoy the sea in the distance. The old woman seemed to do the opposite. After they repeated the broadcast on the PA, I asked her what they were saying. I wondered if she spoke more English than she let on, because she answered right away, "Some man. He died," she said. "Do they always announce that?" I asked. She looked at me blankly. Then she trained her eyes on the cemetery again, like a dog waiting for its dinner. By the time the funeral party arrived an hour later, she had made some syrupy pastries and arranged the brightly colored gummies of Turkish delight into a box and pressed her black dress before heading back out to the balcony to observe the grieving. We watched together. A pack of strays was circling the sparse crowd. I had been studying up on the myths in preparation for my job, and I thought of Hades, god of the underworld, and his three-headed dog. After the coffin was lowered into the rectangular hole, the old woman sent me down to the funeral party with the sweets she had prepared. I didn't know who to give them to. I stood, stupid, for a long few minutes before she yelled something in Turkish, and one of the older ladies came and took them from me. I said thank you, and she patted me on the head. Then, remembering a contraption I had built for my treehouse back home, I went inside and rigged up a basket on a string tied to the balcony so that the old woman could lower her offering herself and I could stay safely out of other people's funerals. Her face brightened when I showed it to her. "How do you pronounce your name?" I asked. I pointed at myself and said, "David." Then I pointed at her with a question mark in my eyes. She made a series of sounds, beginning with a G, but when I tried to make them back, I spit out an ugly knot. She raised her eyebrows and gave me a look that said, "Do not do that to my name." So I said, "I'll call you Grams. It's a term of endearment. It's nice." She gazed out at the cemetery. She must have known which dead got fake flowers and which ones got real, which dead got tears and which ones got a guilty kneel in the dirt for a second or two and then a fast exit. My first day at work was fun because I had never been to an all-inclusive resort, and I'd had no idea how absurd it would be. My boss, Amir, was Turkish but spoke good English. He told me I was better looking than my photo and then slapped me on the back of the head. The second day was exactly the same as the first, and less fun because of it. The third day, I felt a small weight in my stomach as if a stone had buried itself in the soft muck. The rest of the staff was oblivious to me, and the summer camp camaraderie I had hoped for did not surface. I'd imagined that my U.S. passport would get me laid, if nothing else. I could lead a foreign girl to think she might marry me and my long American dollars. But my country's mystique seems to have faded. The Ukrainians hang out together in their dorms at night. The Turks go home to their families, and I go back to Graham's and sit on the porch, watching over the dead. For 6 weeks, I have repeated the pattern. Tea and bread with Grams, beard and myths in the tent, meals alone in the staff cafeteria, tea with Grams above hundreds of graves, sleep. The only pleasurable part of the day is when I swim in the sea, cold and wine dark. Each week, from the other side of the world, my mother asks, "Have you been to a mosque yet?" And each week, I have not. I sit in the story tent, waiting for customers. I tell one straggler how Cronus, believing he would be overthrown by a son, swallowed his first 5 children. "How bloody fun," the straggler says in a British drawl. I try to think of something lighter, but the only myth that comes to mind is about Hera forbidding all the gods, goddesses, and nymphs to allow Leto to give birth on land, forcing the laboring woman to row across the sea for days until she found a rootless, drifting island surrounded by swans. The straggler falls asleep. My beard is hot and itchy. What kind of escape is this? In 2 weeks, I will go home with nothing but a handful of odd details to show for my summer. I imagine the other kids coming back from summers spent surfing every day. I imagine Ethan Peters and Jessica Stride lying side by side on his surfboard, floating out past the break, their skin salty and freckled. They'd kiss. They'd have to. It's the perfect teenage moment for kissing. The long casts of their friends' voices would reel them slowly in, but they'd remember the waves rolling under them, their bodies pressed together, trying not to tip the board, their warm lips and paddling back, each using one arm. Madeline Reagan is in Italy, studying Shakespeare's plays and sketching marble statues with missing anatomy. I imagine a fly landing in those empty penis holes, buzzing around. I already know that Madeline will come back feeling changed, that she will have had a crush on an American boy in her group who paid no attention to her, and that she will have slept with an Italian without meaning to, and that she will be a little carved out by this, but also a little proud. It will be a story she continues to tell in college, a small badge of adult credibility. Marcello would be his name, and he will become a conveniently unknowable person, someone she can change depending on her current needs. He can be a tool to make another boy jealous. He can be the partner in sex acts she pretends to have practiced. Everyone, it seems, will have had a summer that means something. I can already hear the buzz on the first day of school. 500 teenagers with stories to tell. And me? I won't know how to explain anything. I spent the summer at an all-inclusive resort on the Turkish coast with a slew of sunburned Ukrainians. I'll have to explain where both Turkey and Ukraine are to everyone, including the teachers. I lived with an old woman above a cemetery, and I ate a lot of olives, I'll say. And I kissed no one. I fell in love with no one. I told Greek myths to people who spent the whole time joking about yanking off my beard. Evidently, I have traveled 11,000 miles and still found a way to fail at my escape. "Mom," I say into my phone. It is evening and I can hear Grams outside thwacking wet laundry against a pole. I want to convince her to come visit by telling her that we can hop a quick flight to Egypt and see the pyramids. Honey pie, my mother says. Her voice on the other end sounds falsely close, right in my ear. I've been calling all week, I tell her. I know you have. I ended up going on a silent retreat at the last minute. I just needed it. It felt so good. It was wonderful. One of the Dharma talks really reminded me of you. I do not wonder aloud why it didn't remind her enough of me to call back, to remember that I was real, not just the idea of a son, but a fleshy body. Yeah, I say instead. It was about forgiveness, about forgiving yourself. It was beautiful. She has forgiven herself. It doesn't matter whether I join her or not. I do not mention Egypt. It rains for 3 days in a row. There is almost nothing to do indoors at Club Zeus. I am swamped with restless kids and asked to schedule 3 extra sessions. I'm talking 6 hours a day in a scratchy old man voice and running out of myths. Tell one about love, a drunk man says, and I tell the one about Hades trapping Persephone in the underworld with a single pomegranate seed. Tell a better one about love, says the drunk man's wife, and I tell her about how Achilles met Queen Penthesilea in battle, how he saw her courage and fell instantly and deeply in love with her at the same moment he delivered the fatal stab to her neck. The couple leaves without tipping. At my break, the rain has quieted for a moment, so I walk out to the water. An older blonde woman is lying in the rain in a tiny pink bikini. She is tanning. This, I think. This is commitment. Zeus's kebab shack has been turned into a playpen with constant belly dancing contests, indoor bocce ball, and trivia. The British tabloids have sold out completely from the newsstand, even at the 3x markup. There are chubby ladies huddled around the hookah bar looking cold in shorts and tank tops, their faces in the papers.
Everybody thought I was pregnant, but it wasn't a baby. It was a 22-pound cyst.
Emir is making the rounds, as if a little flirtation can distract the women from their ruined holiday. Sudoku grids are being filled in at incredible speed, and the booze is pouring. And then, after lunch and before the late afternoon donut rush, someone notices a fat man face down in the pool. He is bobbing against the topless goddess statue. 5 feet of water, right in the middle of the resort. No splash. His countrymen are all around, with oversweet cocktails and plastic cups, angry sunburns beneath their all-accessed wrist bracelets. The body is gathered by Amir, suddenly serious, suddenly silent, with the help of 2 leaf-collecting nets. He, the man who isn't anymore, is given a piggyback ride on the shoulders of a solemn Russian giant of a woman. I watch her eyes as she lumbers toward the medical center. His skin is scattered with small moles. Relief at not being the carrier burns off the people who follow her like steam. I am standing in front of the story tent, feeling belly up. My fingers graze the buttons on my phone. I keep patterning the U.S. country code. I calculate the time difference in my head. It's the middle of the night in Orange County, and my mother is too far away to save me. A woman runs to the pool and stands there, searching. It is the woman I saw tanning in the rain, I realize. Her hair is white blonde and wet, and her face is Russian, without question, firm and resolved, as if it has always known that this would come. His wife. She looks straight at me. He's dead, she says, before anyone else says the words. What is there to say to a woman whose husband is just drowned in a pool he easily could have stood up in? I'm sorry, I say. She does not blame me or any of the other people who should have been watching. Thank you. We will also die someday. She reaches behind the bar and takes a huge bottle of vodka, pours a plastic cup full. The bartender says, "Take the whole thing, please. Take anything you want." No one does any work the rest of the day. We wander around, gathering wet towels.